I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next. A dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
And good morning. Welcome to What's Next. Today on What's Next, we're going to be talking about one of my favorite topics, and that is the arts in Western New York. And more specifically, we're going to talk about a program that was created to remove the barriers prohibiting many Western New Yorkers from experiencing the arts, including the cost, transportation, language, and effort. With us from Art Services, Inc., Liv Duke, Programs and Services Coordinator. Liv, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
And also with us, Tracy Snyder, Executive Director, Theater of Youth. Hi, Tracy.
Hi, thank you for having us.
This is great. This is, like I said, this is one of my favorite things to talk about here, arts in Western New York. But it's great to, you know, I guess I had known a little bit about the Arts Access Program, Liv, but I'll let you kind of lay out exactly what it is.
Yeah, so the Arts Access Program is a program that was started by our organization, Art Services, Inc. We often go by ASI, in 2013, and it was essentially created to remove those barriers, as you said, to folks accessing the arts, those including time, cost, transportation, knowledge, and effort. And it's anybody that receives income-based public assistance across Western New York in Erie, Niagara, or Chautauqua counties is eligible for this program, whether that be SNAP, WIC, HEAP, or Medicaid. Once you apply to the program, you receive a pass that has your name on it, and you can use that pass to access the arts for free at over 60 of our arts and culture partners across Western New York. And you can use that pass for free admission and free tickets to these events and shows. And it's really wonderful. The folks get to get out and appreciate the arts for free.
Yeah. So just to clarify then, so you get this pass,
mm-hmm.
where you can go to any of these partners, like about 60 of them.
Yep, there's 60 different partners. You take your pass. It's good for yourself, the pass holder, and a guest, whether that be a caretaker, a child, a spouse, a friend, anybody. You can take that pass. You'll get admission for yourself and that guest, and you can go there for free.
So I'll just lay out some places. The Reg Lanet Center for the Arts, mm-hmm. in Jamestown's one.
Yep.
Let's see, the Darwin Martin House, of course, in North Buffalo, and Theater of Youth.
Yes.
How about that? What a great transition. So what about that, Tracy? You talk about kind of getting involved in this program and you know, what it, you know, kind of how it kind of plays itself out at the Theater of Youth.
Sure. So I don't even know how long we've been a partner in this program with ASI.
Yeah, I think a long time.
A long time. Yeah. I started with the company in 2019, and I have continued that partnership. And it's really wonderful because we offer two branches of our season programming. One is our year-round education workshops, and then the second is our main stage performances. So this season, we're doing three shows, and all of those are aligned with ASI and the Arts Access. And so, as Liv said, people can come and reserve two tickets for them and a guest. And we see everyone from families to adult individuals that can come take advantage and see a live performance.
And, of course, I would think it's quite an opportunity because, Theater of Youth is known for a lot of things, but the holiday programming, Theater of Youth is kind of really like a legendary part of the art scene here. Do you see different faces like that coming up that might be taking advantage of arts access?
Oh, absolutely. You know, like I said, even just at my time at TOI, we see families of all ages coming, and then, like I said, adult individuals. And this holiday season, we are having a holiday offering.
How about that?
We're doing Junie B. Jones in Jingle Bells Batman Smells. So I don't know if you're familiar with the Junie
I
B.
Know
book
Junie B.
series.
Sure. Read a few to my daughter. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's really fun. And again, it's something for all ages and families. That's the thing. We really want families to come and allow children and adults to have that shared experience. Because I think sometimes as we get older, we can forget a little bit what it's like to be a child, but to see, as we always say, it's really about the wonders and worries of childhood, and we support programming that shines a lens on that so that a child really sees their story being told. But it's also relatable to adults in the audience as well, because you get those reminders of the magic or the concerns even that you had as a child. And then you get to share that with your children or children in your lives. So it's really a special experience to share.
Concerns I had back when I was a child. I'll have to revisit that discussion someday.
It's really about, you know, anxiety and grades and friendships and stress. And, you know, now today the world has changed so much with cell phones. But sometimes that is a factor in our programming. And sometimes it's a little more classical, you know, pre-technology elements. But, we really try to focus on different experiences that children have, and how can we emulate that in performances? What are the themes that we're focused on? And we also, in many years, we have such a strong tie to schools in the area because we offer field trip daytime performances during the week. And so we focus on, well, what are schools covering? Are there literary adaptations that we can bring to students and schools to really align with the curriculum, as well as offer engaging programs?
And so there is like alignment with school programs?
Yes. So this season we're doing Junie B. Jones. We're doing an adaptation of The Hobbit. And then we're ending the season with Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus.
Okay.
Based on Mo Wilhelm's character, the pigeon. There's a whole series of books.
Okay.
And so all three of those things are based on books. So you're really seeing those stories come to life in a unique way live on stage. So these books are sometimes covered in the classroom as part of curriculum. And then even if those books aren't specifically covered, there are other books similar. There are other adventure or mystical stories that are covered that are similar to The Hobbit. And I know that Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus and Junie B. Jones are taught in the classroom and part of reading.
And are you hearing them from educators who say, yeah, we're seeing an increased level of interest in these books and in reading, more importantly, because of the programming of Theater of Youth?
We are. Yeah. Actually, I can say that this year, well, the past couple of years since programming came back from the pandemic with field trip performances, we have been tied to the Buffalo Public Schools with their field trip initiative. So we have, I think, 6 shows dedicated just to BPS performances, which is dynamite because this initiative allows, their goal is every student in all of the grades get to go on at least one field trip a year. And so they come to their kindergartners, come to Theater of Youth. And this year they're coming to Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus.
Okay.
And we've actually had to add 6 shows to our field trips because the demand is so great. And it's a wonderful,
great problem to
wonderful
have, huh?
thing to navigate. But it's just because engagement is so high. And, you know, you have to remember kids didn't go on a field trip for so many years, and especially focusing on kindergartners or elementary school, these kids may have never gone on a field trip because think about their age and the pandemic. We're only 4 years out from this, so that is their elementary experience.
Right, right.
So to see them come into the theater, and you know, Theater of Youth is so unique because we're in the historic Allendale Theater.
Right.
And so when you walk in, if you're not familiar, you don't realize how big it is. Mm-hmm. And to have these little ones come in and it's this massive theater, it's so magical. And then again, to see them watching stories that are made for them on stage it's just wonderful. They interact with the actors. They'll do shout outs or call outs and responses and their laughter, their clapping. It is, there's no other audience like an audience full of children.
Wait, you know, so Liv, when it comes to, you know, engagement, and I'll use the word that, that Tracy just used, is there, when it comes to Arts Access, the program, you know, how about that? How do you go about engaging to attract people to this opportunity? Because it really is a wonderful opportunity.
Yeah, it really is. And we tend to lean on some different partnerships. You know, we're an arts service agency, so we often don't have those relationships with maybe people that are receiving these benefits naturally. So we'll partner with different community centers, different kind of caseworkers, people that are working with these individuals daily and have those close relationships with them. So we lean on them to kind of help sign folks up and teach them about the program. I also go to lots of different tabling events, and I love being out in the community and signing up pass holders, telling them about the program. And we also kind of rely on the partner locations as well to kind of spread the word, whether that be handing out our rack cards or just letting people know about the program, that they're able to use their pass at their place.
You know, the tabling events can be really a fascinating experience.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of curious about that experience when people find out, because there must be a little bit of surprise.
But, yeah.
Well, I'm sorry, you're offering me a free opportunity,
yes,
to go for entertainment in West,
yeah,
New York.
My right. response is often, I know, it's almost too good to be true. they're like, wait, you mean I can go to all these places for free? How did I never know about this? And I'm like, I'm not really sure, but now you're a part of it. And word of mouth is amazing at those places, too. They'll take 5 or 6 applications and hand them out to all of their friends and family, which is a great way to spread the word. But yeah, I love getting to interact with future and current pass holders at tabling events out in the community. We love attending different events and getting to introduce folks to the program, whether that it be for themselves or for somebody that they know. Maybe they work at a school. Maybe they're a caseworker, and they can spread the word to folks that would be eligible. So it's just a really nice way to kind of see who's interested and spread the word right there in person.
How many, did you say 3,000 people right now have the Arts Access?
We just wrapped up the previous season in August, and we had over 3,000 pass holders, which is double from the previous season. So it's really expanding pretty rapidly, and we're really, really excited about that.
Okay, so you said season, That season is behind us.
We've kind of changed the model a little bit. All of the partners renew in August, just to make sure that they're still a part of the program. That's when we often bring on new partners. But the passes are good for a year from when you apply. So if you apply next month in October, you'll renew that in next October. And that's just to confirm that you're still receiving those benefits. We have all the correct information for you. Most people are likely still eligible, but we just ask that you reapply every year for the program.
Okay, well, that makes sense, because there are, like you said, there are qualifications involved. Yep. Transportation is something that's also part of this. That's interesting.
Yeah, so a big barrier to accessing the arts for sure is transportation. It's getting to these places, especially if you live in a more rural community outside of kind of the metro area where public transportation is accessible. So through Arts Access, every pass holder has the opportunity to reserve free, reliable, and accessible transportation. And we partner with an organization called Heart Transportation, and they provide their transportation for us. So pass holders will give me a call or fill out something online, let us know a few weeks in advance where they would like to go, what time they'd be picked up. And the driver will come pick them up right at their house, take them to the place they'd like to go, any of those partner organizations. So if they're seeing a show or going to a museum or any sort of offering that they're using their pass for, they can use this transportation. They get dropped off right there, picked up when they're done, and taken back home. And it's accessible as well. So if you are in a wheelchair or have any sort of mobility challenges, they're able to accommodate that as well.
You mentioned rural areas. What is the outreach? How successful have you been in outreach?
It's a little bit more challenging, just because a lot of those the partner organizations aren't quite located in those rural areas. But we've seen it's definitely growing in success, especially kind of in the Niagara County areas. Who doesn't love going to the aquarium, especially for free? So that's been successful to kind of have some places that they'd like to go to. And we're also expanding into Chautauqua County more.
Right.
We currently have a handful of organizations as a part of the program there, including the Chautauqua Institution, the Reg Linnae, as you mentioned, Roger Torrey Peterson Institute, and Sukanya Berman Dance Company. So we're kind of trying to expand more into that area, especially in, you know, Jamestown and Fredonia. We're not quite located there. Our office is located in the city of Buffalo, but we serve the five counties of Western New York. But it's, of course, a challenge to it's significantly farther away. But we know that there's a need in that community, and we have really excited partners down there. We really value the partnerships that we already have, and we're using that to kind of grow some future partnerships and outreach efforts down in the southern tier in Chautauqua County.
And I'm thrilled that you mentioned the Sukanya Berman Dance Company, because they were a feature on What's Next not too long ago, about a month or so ago, as a matter of fact.
They're one of the newest partners for the program. They just joined the program this past year.
Yeah, it's one of those great examples of how the arts can really change the landscape for a lot of folks and communities as well. Our guest this morning, Liv Duke of Art Services, Inc., the Programs and Services Coordinator, also Tracy Snyder, Executive Director of Theater of Youth, with us here this morning. And we're talking specifically about the Arts Access Program. Let's turn the conversation around, because both of you have pretty extensive backgrounds in the arts. And I guess I'm going to try to lean this towards a little bit is there a frustration when it comes to perhaps the obstacles that are blocking people from getting to the arts, whether it is financial or transportation, or just maybe a general understanding of the arts or an appreciation for the arts? Just wonder if you want to try to tackle this one on it and get into this. I know there's a lot there, but I guess what I'm always interested in is the value of arts. I can say I value it, you can, but that message is not necessarily universal. Who wants to try to get into that a little bit here?
Yeah, so at ASI, in the past 2 years, we have worked with Americans for the Arts to gather a lot of survey data. Our team was kind of boots on the ground collecting survey data for 2 years in partnership with I think around 150 organizations across the five counties. And we gathered data that was folks that were attending these arts and cultural events and folks that were interacting with these organizations, whether they were in our community or they were tourists that were visiting. The majority of them were locals here. And with Americans for the Arts, we put together an Arts and Economic Prosperity Report, which we launched in January and can be found in full on our website. But with that study, we were really able to look at the economic and social impact that the arts have on our community. And it was really, really wonderful, the impact. We saw really high numbers of folks that have deep pride for the arts and culture landscape of our region. It's something that people are really proud of. And there was over an 85% of folks said that they would feel such a loss if these organizations were no longer around or if they weren't able to access them. So that was some cool kind of data that we were able to pull to support that. And we provided all that data to, you know, our elected officials and our organizations that we work closely with so that they can advocate for more funding for themselves. And, you know, a huge barrier to the arts in all ends of it is the money aspect of it.
Sure.
It's expensive to attend an arts event a lot of times, and it's expensive to run an arts organization. So it's kind of, there's not a clear answer to it, obviously, but at ASI, we try to do all that we can to support those organizations through grant funding and funding opportunities that we share through other organizations to kind of support their causes. And then in support, they're also in turn, they're also supporting the Arts Access by donating those tickets to the program so that community members can attend for free.
Yeah, and then Tracy, we mentioned this before we went on the air about how it was Liv's organization, Arts Services, Inc., that kind of gave you the heads up that there might be a less state funding coming, you know, in general for everybody, but might impact your operation as well. Maybe talk about that relationship of how art services kind of gives you something that you know, helps you out because you've got plenty to do. You got to, you know, take care of the theater programming. All the bills have to be paid. All that stuff that's, you know, very much a challenge for the theater scene here in Western New York.
Sure. So like many theaters and cultural organizations, you know, Theater of Youth, we only have 2 full-time annual employees, mm-hmm. and then seasonal employees or artists. And so between the two of us, as you said, there's a lot that we have to navigate and keep organized. And, you know, sometimes it is kind of, you know, head in the sand with our day-to-day work, but I can always count on ASI for really leading the forefront charge for advocacy. And part of that, as you just said, is, you know, they gave us a heads up before we really knew what was going on with the potential for NISCA, New York State Council on the Arts, to potentially cut funding this year. And so they said, well, not only might this happen, but you can be a part of it. You can write letters to your representatives. You can fill out this survey. You can, you know, these are the connections. And so they really lay things out for you to save time and energy, and but yet make an impact. And that's the thing, is that they really lead that charge. And then we can jump on that wagon or ask questions. And they really put us in touch with leaders that we might need to reach out to. So they're just so dynamite. And it's something that I know that I personally and professionally am so grateful to them for their leadership within the arts community at large with Western New York.
Does the Theater of Youth get NISCA funding?
We do. We've been very lucky that on and off, you know, NISCA is wonderful, as is ASI, that they offer operational grants and funding. Mm-hmm. And that's really, I know a lot of theaters and cultural organizations struggle with trying to find just operational funds, because you never want to create a program just to get funding. But sometimes, you know, funding is program specific, and so right. It can be challenging. But
sure.
Just the operation, the day-to-day, there is such, as Liv said, such a high need for funding, and it costs to operate. You know, TOI is a 501c3, so we do take donations. But I think two of the challenges that we have is awareness of TOI. Mm-hmm. We're entering our 53rd season, but we come into contact with so many people that don't know we exist,
right.
Have never heard of us, or don't really know enough about us. And we personally have the trouble, or struggle, I should say, that our clients age out of our programs.
Okay.
So it's a wonderful opportunity because there are always new generations and new children, but it's also a struggle because you have new families. I, for one, I have a 4.5-month-old now, first-time mom.
Congratulations.
Thank you. But it's a challenge.
Your 4.5-month-old is, name is?
Lily.
Oh, hi, okay. Lily.
Yes,
good, Lily.
Lillian.
Yes. All right.
And you can get overwhelmed,
sure.
with your day-to-day, and you don't know what's out there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, trying to raise awareness that, hey, Theater of Youth is for you. You can come and see shows, and it's professionally produced theater. That's the other misconception, is a lot of people think that it's children performing for children, but we are professional. And so it's primarily adult actors performing for children and their families. So raising awareness. But as a parent, as an individual, and as an arts leader, I can go to ASI to find information about not only their services, but connections to the community and what is offered for, you know, whether you're a grandparent wanting to take your grandchild to a show, mm-hmm. or an individual wanting to get out and experience something in the arts.
Yeah, and that knowledge part of it is a huge barrier that folks don't often think of. You know, we think easily of cost and transportation, but, you know, I talk to a lot of pass holders that before joining this program had no idea that the majority of these places even existed in this community that they've lived in their whole lives.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we send out a newsletter to pass holders about upcoming events. We are constantly reminding them about all of these great opportunities, and also sharing free events where even if they have a friend that's not a pass holder, everybody can attend for free, or, you know, they could always bring them as their guest. But that knowledge part is a huge, you know, barrier to accessing the arts, and not only through Arts Access, but also with ASI as a whole. We try to kind of bust that down as much as we can. We administer and we announce different calls for work for artists, whether it's a mural project or a public art project. We're spreading the word about those opportunities for artists. We send out a monthly newsletter, a weekly newsletter that has career opportunities, funding opportunities, anything that you might be interested to know as an artist. The knowledge part, there's so much information out there, and especially as a working artist or an artist that is just doing it on the side, there's so many opportunities for them, and we try to let them know about them as much as we can.
Right, and so art services, you know, we talked about the arts access pass, but mm-hmm. there is an overview of opportunities for organizations like Theater
for sure.
of Youth that they can take advantage of. Let's maybe just have a little discussion about what that is.
Absolutely. So Arts Services, Inc., we often go by ASI. We're kind of an arts service agency. So we're also a nonprofit, 501c3, but we are kind of a resource hub for all things artists, arts organizations, arts administrators, and then also that community aspect with arts access in particular. But we provide a lot of different kinds of resources to artists or arts professionals, arts administrators, whether that be funding. We administer different grants throughout the year, grants that we fundraise for and grants that we receive funding from the state to administer locally. And that is direct support to artists that are creating new work, creating projects, organizations that are maybe receiving a general operating grant to keep their lights on and make their payroll, or are putting on a new arts program. We also do a lot of different professional development workshops, conferences, training programs for artists and arts administrators. We also offer different financial services like bookkeeping. We offer low-cost bookkeeping to arts and culture organizations across Western New York, and also fiscal sponsorship. So if you're applying for a grant, we can be kind of your work through as a fiscal sponsor. Advocacy, as we kind of talked about, at local, state, and national levels. That's kind of the
right. Well, Tracy, ASI. I mean, so you've been able to take advantage of some of these opportunities?
Absolutely. I've attended a lot of their professional development workshops, both as an admin, but also as a teaching artist or an actor, just to learn new information, get new resources, even meet other colleagues. Mm-hmm. You know, working in the theater, you can get kind of siloed
right.
with just theater connections, but it's so important to go. And as a teaching artist, I've attended workshops too. And so to meet other artists of different mediums, and other backgrounds, it's so important to get that feedback, especially from coming out of the pandemic, how other people are dealing with challenges or resources that they're utilizing or have heard of, and just create a more well-rounded community. Definitely taking advantage of ASI's programming.
And then, you know, again, we brought you here to talk about arts access. You know, Liv, you talk to these pass holders on a frequent basis. What do you hear?
You know, as you can imagine, they love the program. It's a really wonderful program, and it's easy to love. But I love hearing the testimonies from these pass holders, whether they're coming into the office to renew their pass, I'm talking to them on the phone to book transportation, or help them through any challenges. But just earlier this week, a couple came in to renew their pass. They've been pass holders for years, and they were saying how they're able to take their grandkids to the AKG for the first time. I told them that they should go to Toy when the season starts. But they're able to take their grandkids to experience these arts and culture things that they personally love, and now they're able to share it with their grandkids. I work with a lot of individuals that are maybe living alone or isolated or aren't really able to leave their house very often. One particular pass holder comes to mind. She's a new pass holder. She just applied maybe 6 or 9 months ago. And through the Arts Access program, we book her transportation. So someone comes and picks her up. She went to Art Park a couple times this summer and even met up with some other pass holders. And they created this, you know, beautiful friendship and connection. And they've gone to a couple different places together now. And she's talked about how thankful she is that this gives her the opportunity to get out of the house and experience the arts that she's loved her whole life, but hasn't really been able to experience. And that transportation is a big part of it. And also just the knowledge aspect, and of course the financial barrier. But it's just really lovely to hear stories of folks that, you know, they love the arts, or maybe they've never experienced the arts, and this program is allowing them to kind of renew that passion or get out there for the first time and experience all that our community has to offer.
And of course, part of that is the Theater of Youth. So Tracy, we can't go away without making sure that we understand what's coming up, especially the holidays. For some reason, I always connect Theater of Youth and the holidays together.
I love that. I love that so much. So this season, we're doing three main stage productions. So first up in December, we will be running Junie B. Jones in Jingle Bells, Batman Smells.
I can't believe you can roll that off your tongue like that. I'm sorry.
It's fun for the whole family. And then in the new year, at the end of February and March, we will be running an adaptation of The Hobbit.
So what are the expectations for The Hobbit? I'm just wondering about that. I mean, because obviously The Lord of the Rings, it's huge.
Absolutely. So it's going to be a spectacle. What's really wonderful about this adaptation, it's by Gregory Banks, who, if you have seen any productions in the past, Gregory Banks also did an adaptation that we did of Robin Hood, as well as there was another one that I'm blanking on, but the director for this is Chris Kelly. Okay. So anyone that has seen a Chris Kelly show knows that he has such a unique approach, and it's really this wonderful blend of really understanding the text for the actors, but then also a bit of that spectacle nature. And so The Hobbit, you can expect a magical adventure, and The Hobbit is so interesting because it's really, you know, the theme are not only adventure, but it's really about self-discovery and friendship and challenges and how to overcome that, and a little bit of that good versus evil, and how do we triumph and discover adventure and joy in our everyday lives. That's, you know, if you know Bilbo, that's really so it's going to be really unique. And it is, I believe it's just a 6-person cast, 5 or 6 people. And so everyone plays multiple roles as well. So it's going to be a real acting challenge for our actors. But that also means it's going to be a really unique experience for our audiences to really see how they morph and change into these different characters. So it's going to be quite an adventure.
And the season wraps up with
Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus, the musical, which I don't know if you're familiar with the Pigeon book series by Mo Willems, but it's going to be really fun. And that pigeon, just that feisty pigeon, that's all I can say. We'll have puppets and it's a musical, and that's going to be really great for the real littles to come to see a show. So again, families can come, and if you know the books, if you want a good time, come and see Don't Let the Pigeon Drive the Bus in May.
And then finally, Liv, how somebody, if they're interested in finding out more about the Arts Access Pass, what do they do?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're eligible for the program or just want to learn more, definitely check out our website. It's arts-access.org. You can apply online right through our website and learn more for a full list of our partner organizations and accessing that transportation as a pass holder as well. You can also always stop into our office to apply or learn more.
You're right there at the Tri-Main?
Yep, we're in the Tri-Main Center.
Fourth floor.
Fourth floor, all the way down at the end on the right. Or you can give us a call or send us an email. I'd love to chat and talk more about Arts Access and get you signed up and involved.
Well, we loved the chat this morning.
Yes.
Liv Duke is the Programs and Service Coordinator with Arts Services, Inc., and Tracy Snyder is Executive Director of Theater of Youth. Thanks for being with us on What's Next.
Thank you so much.
Stay with us. There's more to come. This is What's Next on WBFO.
Hey there, news junkie. Do you have a quick moment? Visit WBFO.org on your phone or computer, or if you feel like talking, call 1-877-456-8870 and make a generous donation to your NPR station, WBFO. When you do, you become a direct supporter of local journalism. That kind of action is essential to our community's access to news. Become a part of something important today.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
So, David, we talked when you formed, or were helping to form this this center for Information Integrity at the University of Buffalo. Let's get an update. How have things grown for the center? What have we seen so far?
So I would be remiss if I didn't mention that the person behind the scenes here, driving the conversations that basically brought us together, is Chitra Rajan, Associate Vice President for Research at UB. She got about 20 of us to converse for a bunch of Friday afternoons, for 2 or 3 months. And eventually those conversations led to the conception of a potential research center. That was in the fall of 2021 when we first applied for center status. Was just about this time in 2021. So in 3 short years, we've come quite far. We have now over 40 faculty members. We have been able to, thankfully, attract funding from the National Science Foundation for a specific project that aims to empower older citizens, 60 and older, to recognize the dangers they face, particularly with regards to financial scams that can be not just financially, but emotionally devastating for them. So we have, together with partners in other institutions around the country, our approach is to, and when I say our, this is a project actually led by my partner, co-director Siwei Liu.
Yes.
But our approach has been to think of our senior partners as essentially allies that can help spread the word with their friends and family. So that's one of the projects that we've been working on. We did a soft launching of some of this stuff a few months ago. Our plan is to convert this into a self-sustaining enterprise, not dependent on grant funding anymore. We are calling it DART Collective. And DART stands for Deception Awareness and Resilience Training.
Okay.
So that's one of the most successful projects that we have been involved in. We have also published a series of mini articles. Bruce was involved in one or two of them. And we have also published a collection of essays. SUNY Press has published it. This was a collaboration with the Humanities Institute. A few years back, we founded a book series with SUNY Press with the title Humanities to the Rescue.
Right. I remember it well.
So CII and HI, the Humanities Institute, partner for this project. So we have the book came out in a couple of months ago called Truth Seeking in Our Age of Misinformation Overload. The essays are quite enlightening. And they span a multitude of disciplines. From Bruce here has an article from a mathematical modeling perspective. And we have participants, contributors, all the way from computer science and engineering to arts and humanities and social sciences, etc. So our approach has been, at this point, is basically about first creating or contributing to create a community of faculty who are interested in collaboration around the topic of mis and disinformation. The focus has been, depending on, you know, the interest that these faculty members have, but essentially at this point, we've had people working on AI and ethics, AI justice, people working on communicating climate change science and some of the pitfalls of misinformation in that area, democracy and civil rights. And we've had some of the folks in the medical school partnering with people in theater and dance to combat misinformation in the health fields, with a special focus on the misinformation that was circulating during the pandemic. So that gives you a sense of what we've been doing.
Wide ranging, for sure. And you mentioned how we're trying to develop allies and friends to help carry this along. Well, you happen to bring a couple of your allies with us, Jasmina Tachova and also E. Bruce Pittman. So maybe let's just open up a conversation about that. The things, you know, like you said, trying to spread the word. I'm curious, it's always somewhat foreboding to approach a scholar when it comes to have discussions, but it's always a great opportunity to utilize the resources. So what are the conversations that you're having with, whether it's, you know, your significant other, students, other faculty members? When it comes to information and misinformation, what kind of conversations are you having?
I think for me, one of the biggest pieces of, maybe I can even call it misinformation out there, because I think the lack of information sometimes is just as harmful as having the wrong information, particularly around generative artificial intelligence, because this seems to be on everyone's mind right now, is that, you know, when we use these really sleek user interfaces, probably most of your listeners by now have at least heard of ChatGPT and maybe even have tried using it.
Maybe once or twice.
I was just getting coffee at UB a few months ago, and I overheard a group of undergraduate students discussing the fact that they've been trying to use it on pretty much all their homework assignments. I would definitely argue that the success rate of that is still not very good. Hopefully, in terms of, you know, because it's really not that advanced. And I think that's a lot of hype still around the actual level of achievement that these algorithms can have outside of really narrow and well-defined problems, of course. But one of the misconceptions, I think, which I think has a really steep social cost, is that because we're interacting with these systems through an interface, and they live somewhere on the cloud beyond our perception, that they're therefore immaterial and don't really have any real effect on even the environment, if you will. But there are studies that just came out a couple of months ago saying that one single search on platforms like ChatGPT that require a lot of computational power is equal to somewhere in the ballpark of one bottle of water. And this is like a 16-ounce water bottle that it consumes to just cool off the servers that produce all this information. So there is a real environmental cost associated with us using generative AI over, let's say, a Google search, which also, of course, comes with a real impact on the environment. But it's estimated that ChatGPT search is about 10 times more energy intensive than a Google search. So I just wanted to put that out there for people to know that even though we're interacting with these systems through a graphic user interface, there's not a lot of understanding of where and how the data that we get back through these interfaces gets generated, but it has a real impact on our environment.
Bruce, I was going to ask you then, is that part of maybe, I don't want to say the problem, but it's this reality that, as Jasmina was talking about, you're on your computer, you're just sending out, you know, whatever. It feels like something we've gotten so accustomed to doing these types of things that it's part of us, but yet we're separate from it. I'm curious about that reality. And then when it comes to how we now are getting this information, whether it's misinformation or whatever the case may be, or we just plain out trust, whatever we send out into the computer world comes back to us is real and true.
I would never trust, right?
But at the same time, you would accept that many people do.
Absolutely. Yeah. At the very best, it's sort of like the old game of telephone, right? You may send something to the person next to you and it goes 10 times around and it comes back to you somewhat distorted.
Right.
That's at the best, right? If that happens in pure human communications without the possibility of somebody tampering with it along the way,
right?
The message is going to come back to you altered somehow. So again, you need to sort of understand, does this make sense to me? Does it pass the sniff test? Does it fit into everything else I have learned about, you know, how something behaves or happens? And does it fit? And we need to ask ourselves those questions before we accept something as truth, to be sure.
And maybe this is another place to take the conversation. There are people who are embracing the misinformation, correct? Right? I mean, isn't that as much a part of this problem as anything else?
Absolutely. This is why our focus, we believe, needs to be on seeding awareness, doing whatever we can to raise awareness and seed resilience here. Awareness means, for example, social media. You know, just about everybody uses some form of social media today. But most people are not aware of the fact that the social media traffic is driven by algorithms that have been trained to grab our attention. These are attention extracting.
And it doesn't care if it's true or not true.
It doesn't care.
Insignificant.
That's precisely the point.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, the assumption that these algorithms are likely making, because they are algorithms trained to, again, harvest our attention. And so they are learning about human nature in the process. Hmm. And the assumption that these algorithms are likely making is that false information, as long as it's sensationalist and as long as it creates strong emotional responses, they have a higher chance of grabbing and maintaining your attention than truthful information. As a matter of fact, at some point I read that Twitter, back when it was Twitter, truthful information did not stand much of a chance against sensationalist fake news. As a matter of fact, if my memory serves me right, there was a 5 or 6 to 1 ratio when it came to false information being, you know, more likely to spread than truthful information in Twitter. And that's back when it was Twitter. I'm not sure what it is now that is X.
Wow. Hey, well, then the question then is, if that's the case, if for every one post that's popping up in your feed, 6 might be false. No, how does an individual consumer go about not only, you know, sifting through it for themselves, but maybe trying to fight back in that? Well, your thoughts, Jasmina? No small task.
See, we diagnose the problem, right, and we ask Jasmina to come up with solutions.
Well, I'm glad you're here then.
I don't know about this because, as I mentioned before we started talking in earnest about this, I did come back to school because I felt there is so much work that is still not finished for me as an now educator. And so I came back to UB for a second PhD program, and I went specifically to the humanities, to the Department of Comparative Literature, because believe it or not, even before ChatGPT made AI a household name in 2022, we were having courses there, even before the pandemic, on the social implications of AI. So one kind of lesson that I took away from this, which I hope can help our listeners deal with this, or maybe can be a gateway to some sort of a solution, not really the solution itself yet, but is the fact that technological progress doesn't really necessarily equal social progress. And I know this sounds simple, but it really is profound, at least in my opinion, because it kind of suggests that even though technology always develops and moves forward, the same does not necessarily go for society. And we can see in the example of misinformation that's generated and propagated through social media nowadays that it's really true, and many people do buy this information because it fits with their social world at the time. And it's really concerning to see that even chief technologists, for example, Elon Musk, oftentimes may propagate scenarios and conspiracy theories that are clearly false. And yet, because they come from someone who clearly knows so much about technology, people tend to believe that. But the reality is, just because we have these shiny new things now doesn't mean that we're better off as a society and we're closer to solving actual social issues than we were before. In fact, these technologies themselves create a lot of inequities at the same time that they're also intensifying existing inequalities. So
Jasmina makes great points about this. And this is why it's important to be aware of the fact that the problem we're facing, while it may be new in terms of scale and volume in the digital age, it's a problem we've been facing at least since the invention of writing, and especially with the spread of the print technology in early modern Europe in the 1600s. If you think about it, with print technology came the democratization of knowledge to some extent. But demagogues took hold of this technology early on to create all kinds of conspiracy theories, disinformation, I mean, the early modern Europe is flooded with all kinds of nefarious conspiracy theories that are often racist at heart. And, you know, even monarchical governments at the time are effectively using what would be akin to a propaganda ministry. At the time, I can talk about, you know, early modern Spain, the monarchy there was created an office of royal chronicler that was meant to come up with a totally fantastical history of Spain as an always already Catholic nation, as a way to solidify a version of Spain that excluded the descendants of Jews and Muslims, for example. So the problems we are facing today are not necessarily new. And a part of this awareness campaign that we are looking to contribute to would need sort of the longer version of history so that we understand that our historical time is not so unique and that we can actually learn from the past, not only from the, you know, the strategies used by the demagogues of the past, but also by the strategies used by the dissidents who found ways to challenge those propagandists. And as you know, one of those people for me, one of the people I trust is Miguel de Cervantes.
Yes, of course, of course.
And there is a reason for this. I mean, when we were talking about patterns earlier, you know, how recognizing patterns of misinformation, patterns of manipulation, it's one way to get to at least a basic awareness, to be on the lookout for things that, you know, if, as Bruce said, if certain things that don't really fit other information I'm getting, what's wrong with this? If it's getting, you know, if it's stirring an emotional response, you know, that comes closer to the possibility that it could be manipulative. These kinds of things. So the best, the easiest way, or the most, the simplest way I try to put this is that if we are looking to think critically about these things, you know, thinking critically, thinking outside the box requires seeing the box. And to me, this is part of what a humanistic training can do. So Cervantes is my champion, sure, so to speak, but it's not just Cervantes. It's, generally speaking, a humanistic training can get us to at least start the conversation about not just the volume of information, the assumption that more information is going to solve the problem created by massive amounts of information is a fallacy.
I appreciate the historical perspective there, because then I'm going to put the final question of our conversation to you, E. Bruce Pittman, and it's this. I'll ask you to just share your thoughts and opinions. Okay, we heard how from back in the start of the printing press, there was misinformation, yet here we are, these many centuries later. Now we're talking about, you know, AI. What about that? Is it, are we going to just hopefully just get through another part of history and there are going to be heroes coming forward here who are going to make this all better? Or is the concern more grave than that?
To me, the concern is quite grave. What I'm hoping is, and I am hopeful, at least in a small grain, that we will do a better job this time. I think about the laissez-faire, hands-off approach that the U.S. took to, say, social media 15, 20 years ago, where anything went with social media. There were no regulations about truthfulness or hatred speech or anything else on social media. And of course, there are all kinds of issues to weigh there, free speech issues and things like that, that are critically important to us. But society, we never challenged social media things, particularly this generative AI that's come out since, you know, Thanksgiving of 2022, that are, you know, allow the ChatGPTs and interactions and making images and things like that and making deepfake images that much easier. There is a questioning that is going on across the country and, you know, in Western Europe, certainly also, trying to get ahead of it a little bit. People who are calling on our leadership to think about what AI, in particular this generative AI, where it might lead us, what it might do, and to counteract the worst of the possible implications thereof. To think about not deploying facial recognition, for instance, in the U.S., That's a big deal, right? Because we know how often facial recognition software can fail. And it might help in certain respects, right? It might give a human who oversees it leads or help out if there's a human or if there's a responsible person in the loop. Questions about generative AI, this discussion today, we're asking people to start thinking about what the implications of AI might be and to get ahead of it, to help educate people, to help pass appropriate regulations that will prevent the worst of possibilities. And the idea that we're at least having those conversations now at the early stages of these new AI tools, that gives me some hope that maybe we'll be able to, I don't think, control is probably far too strong a word, but at least understand what we're in for and get ahead of it a little bit.
Well, if we could have this conversation extend on, and maybe we'll have to revisit it sometime here in the future. So very much appreciated. And I guess when you get right down to it, a great place to start, if you are interested in it, is the Center for Information Integrity at the University of Buffalo. E. Bruce Pittman, Jasmina Tachiba, and also David Castillo. Thanks very much for joining us on What's Next.
Thank you.
Our pleasure. You.